from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. American diplomacy is needed now more than ever. That's according to veteran diplomat William Burns, a former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State.
We're no longer the only big kid on the geopolitical block. Our alliances, our capacity to build coalitions is a huge asset, and I worry that we're squandering that.
Secretary Burns will join us in studio to discuss how President Trump's approach to dealing with leaders like Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin is hastening the decline of U.S. diplomacy and what needs to be done to restore it. That's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal, former Deputy Secretary of State William Burns argues that U.S. foreign relations are in chaos and that the disorder is striking at a precarious time when the world faces ongoing geopolitical challenges such as a nuclear North Korea, an emboldened Russia, and a crumbling Venezuela. William Burns is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a diplomat for more than three decades. He served in the State Department under five presidents and was ambassador to Jordan as well as ambassador from the United States to Russia from 2005 to 2008. He also participated in the Middle East peace process and started secret talks that led to the Iran nuclear deal. And Bill Burns, good to have you with us. Welcome.
It's great to be with you, Michael, and with your listeners.
And also, I should tell my listeners that you were once described by The Atlantic as America's secret diplomatic weapon, but you are also probably one of the most major figures in the world of diplomacy that we saw throughout the 20th century and into the 21st. And your book opens with a pretty heady time. James Baker had just worked out a deal where the Palestinians and Israelis were talking for the first time. This is at the Madrid conference. Everything looked pretty rosy, and American century looked right straight ahead. In fact, I'm reading about just a feeling then with the markets, with peace, with Russia and China and the Middle East, not necessarily where they are by any means now. And I thought, can we ever go back? And the answer to some extent is maybe in some ways we can pivot, but we really can't go back to that American hegemony, can we?
No, you really can't recapture that moment when the United States truly was the singular dominant player on the international landscape. It was a moment when all the currents on that landscape seemed to be flowing in the direction of the United States and our interests and our values. And it intersected with a group of people in the George H.W. Bush administration, Secretary of State Baker, as you mentioned, who really understood, I think, how to make use of that moment. And they also understood it wasn't going to last forever. And so what they were trying to do was shape an international order that would support not just American interests, but our wider enlightened self-interest for years to come. In other words, beyond that moment of singular American dominance. So that's really what set that moment apart in my experience.
It was called the New World Order by President George H.W. Bush at the time. And we now seem to be in a kind of New World chaos, if you'll forgive me for putting it so bluntly.
No, it's kind of the polar opposite in some ways of that moment, because I deliberately started the book to try to recapture that. It was the intersection of, you know, not only a kind of plastic moment on the international landscape when lots of transformation was afoot and a particularly skilled group of American leaders in foreign policy. And today, I think you have another plastic moment of transformation on the international landscape with the rise of China, the resurgence of Russia, huge existential challenges like climate change, the revolution in technology. But I think that intersects with an American leadership that so far at least has proven, you know, not up to the task of trying to take advantage of that moment, take advantage of the reality that the United States still, in my view, and I don't mean this as a statement of American arrogance, but still has a better hand to play than our principal rivals if we play it wisely. And that's a big if these days.
And you are critical of leadership under President Trump. I think you once said to Judy Woodruff that he conducts foreign policy in a narcissistic manner and maybe even has been somewhat criminal in terms of unilateralism and what he has wrought, shall we say. And yet the trouble began long before Trump
did. No, I mean, I think the drift in American diplomacy and in some respects in, you know, American foreign policy wasn't invented by President Trump. I mean, ever since the end of the Cold War, I think we became a little bit complacent at first about how to get our way in the world. It was hard to build public support, let alone budgetary resources for diplomacy. Then came the huge shock to our system of 9/11 and a further emphasis on military and intelligence tools and a tendency to treat diplomacy as kind of an under-resourced afterthought. So that drift wasn't invented, you know, in November of 2016. I would argue, however, that this administration has accelerated that drift and made it infinitely worse.
Well, let's talk about one of the centerpieces of this administration in terms of foreign policy, and it was something that you were very involved in, played a key role in, and that is the Iran deal.
Mm-hmm.
The Iran deal, President Trump said, was one of the worst deals of all mankind, I think, or words to that effect. And yet when you were negotiating it, and you write in your book that you realized it was a long slog, and that's what diplomacy has to do. It has to be in for the long haul. But still, in many ways, the idea that you had of containment, of doing essentially what was done by so many diplomats with respect to Russia, that was the way to go with Iran. Mm-hmm. We should have been in it. We should still be in it for the long slog.
Yeah, that's my view. I mean, you're right. President Trump has certainly controlled his enthusiasm for the Iran nuclear deal. I think it was a huge mistake to abandon that deal. Just as you suggested, Michael, it took an enormous amount of work, day in, day out, slogging to build leverage on the Iranian nuclear issue, to work with lots of allies and partners around the world to get to the point where the Iranian leadership was prepared to negotiate seriously in order to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. And it wasn't an easy task. As you suggested, we began with secret talks at the beginning of 2013. It was a moment when the minds of the Iranian leadership were focused. Their oil exports, as a result of international sanctions, their oil exports had dropped by 50%. The value of their currency had dropped by 50%. But we coupled that pressure with a willingness to negotiate directly. And, you know, through 9 or 10 rounds of secret talks, most of them taking place in Oman, facilitated by the Omani government, we were able to make pretty rapid progress toward an interim nuclear deal, which froze their program, rolled it back, imposed quite intrusive monitoring and verification procedures, all in return for very limited sanctions relief. So we preserved most of our economic leverage for the later comprehensive talks. Was it a perfect agreement? Of course not. I mean, perfect is rarely on the menu for diplomacy. But it was, I'm convinced to this day, the best of the available alternatives after a decade in which the United States had been at war across the Middle East. It was a demonstration that diplomacy could also produce results.
John Kerry was on this program saying essentially the same thing. And yet there are those who say, by contrast, the Trump administration is carrying on some kind of negotiation. We don't know actually what's going on. You have the whole back channel with Iran, but now it's very open. Kim Jong-un standing there and President Trump talking about him like there's a love affair going on between them or something along these. He's used the word love many times. One has to ask, in terms of diplomacy, he may be making progress on that front in terms of denuclearization. We really don't know. But the back channel, the secret negotiations, as opposed to bringing Kim out and showing him to the world and talking about love?
No, I mean, I think I certainly did not criticize President Trump for engaging directly with Kim Jong-un, North Korea's leader. It's unorthodox to kind of start a diplomatic effort at the top like that. But I couldn't point to a pristine record in American diplomacy with North Korea over the preceding decades. So it was worth that effort, I think. The problem is you've got to connect that personalized diplomacy at the very top with the systematic, methodical diplomatic effort that, you know, you need in order to produce results. Otherwise, diplomacy becomes just an exercise in narcissism. And I think the danger is that we're going to get stuck in that place now. If you could set aside the irony of this statement, given the venom with which President Trump, has directed his criticism at the Iranian nuclear deal, if you could get an interim agreement with the North Koreans, similar to what I just described with the Iranians, what we reached at the end of 2013, it would actually be a significant step forward to freeze their program, roll it back, impose very tight verification procedures in return for modest sanctions relief, keeping the door open to the aspirational goal of full denuclearization. The problem is, I don't think Kim Jong-un has any intention in the foreseeable future of fully denuclearizing. So the question is, for diplomats, is, you know, what can you do in the meantime to reduce the dangers while preserving that ultimate goal?
He also probably looks at what happened with Libya, and you've got John Bolton and Mike Pompeo pretty much offering what they offered to Gaddafi, or at least so it would seem.
Yeah, and that was another set of back-channel negotiations that I was intimately involved in, you know, just after 9/11, when we negotiated with the Libyans first to get Gaddafi out of the business of terrorism and then to give up what was a rudimentary nuclear program. Gaddafi was certainly the most peculiar foreign leader with whom I ever dealt. I remember vividly meeting with him one-on-one, and he had a curious habit in the middle of a conversation of staring up at the ceiling and pausing for 3 or 4 minutes, I assume, to kind of collect his thoughts. And I remember one time he did this. He was always a kind of snappy dresser. He was wearing what you could only describe as a pajama top with photographs of dead African dictators on it. So when he paused to look up at the ceiling, I would spend the 3 or 4 minutes trying to figure out how many of those dead African dictators I could identify. Because he paused a lot in that very long conversation, I got pretty good at identifying them. But
you remember your record or how many you tallied?
No, it wasn't bad by the end of it after, you know, a series of meetings. But, you know, he was a bloodthirsty leader. I never forgot the blood that he had on his hands. I had a good friend who was on Pan Am Flight 103 when it was brought down over Lockerbie, Scotland, who was coming home to spend Christmas with his wife and 2 daughters in the United States. So I understood, you know, what terrorism had produced in that attack. But I also thought diplomacy could produce some tangible results. And that's what we did in that back-channel negotiation with the Libyans.
President Trump seems to be attracted to those with a lot of blood on their hands. I'm not only talking about Kim Jong-un. I'm talking about Putin, for example. And that relationship is one that's pretty hard to scrutinize because it just seems to be an attraction on one hand for leaders of that sort, despots. But on the other hand, who knows what is going on with the oligarchs and Deutsche Bank and whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, certainly the president seems to have a pretty pronounced case of autocrat envy, not just in dealing with Putin. And who knows what lies beyond that, you know, whether it's financial dealings that in some way have created vulnerabilities. I just don't know. But it is true that the president seems comfortable in dealing with lots of the most authoritarian leaders in the world.
If you've just joined us, our guest is William Burns. Bill Burns is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. You talk about the strengths that come from diplomacy, and I want to get to those because there's a lot to be said for diplomacy. But also, when you were in a position and you were actually working with 10 secretaries of state over the years and really very high up in so many negotiations, you wanted to avoid really what happened in Iraq. And you were on record as saying, I don't think this is a very good idea. And a number of things like that where you took a stand and you turned out to be probably either prescient, right, or, you know, depending on whose side. Certainly at the time, one had to ask, and you asked the question, why didn't I resign or why didn't I go to the mat? And big question still, isn't it?
It is. It is. And, you know, that period that you were describing, the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2003, was an incredibly difficult one. I was running the Middle East Bureau in the State Department for Colin Powell, who was the Secretary of State. And I remember one afternoon in the summer of 2002, spending, you know, several hours in the most depressing brainstorming session that I can ever recall over 3.5 decades as a diplomat with 2 of my colleagues, both, you know, Middle East experts like myself. And what we tried to do was make a list of all the things that we thought could go wrong in toppling Saddam Hussein, because I always believed that the military challenge of toppling Saddam, of defeating the Iraqi military, was in some ways the easiest of the challenges. The hardest was going to be what to do on the day after in a very complicated society like Iraq. And so what we tried to do that afternoon, which we later produced in a memorandum called The Perfect Storm, was list all the things that we could go wrong. And it was an imperfect effort, a very imperfect effort, to puncture what we saw to be the recklessly rosy assumptions of people who we believed were in a rush to go to war.
So you mean mainly Dick Cheney or also the president at the time, George Bush?
Well, I mean, I think there was an intersection of several different strands that produced the decision to go to war. I mean, 9/11 was a huge jolt to our system. I think President Bush, President George W. Bush, Trump felt a mission to ensure that that would never happen again. And so the emphasis was on prevention and preemption. I think there was a neoconservative strand, you know, people like some people in the Secretary of Defense's office who thought that toppling Saddam was the way to transform the Middle East, you know, an idea untethered to history of planting the seeds of democracy in the Middle East by toppling the Iraqi regime. And then there was a third strand, kind of the paleoconservative strand, which I always identified with Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, which was less ambitious in some ways than the neoconservatives, but I think held that, you know, toppling the Taliban in Afghanistan after 9/11 was necessary but not sufficient. It wasn't a strong enough signal to, you know, anybody who might try to do harm to the United States again. And I think the intersection of those strands, you know, led us to, you know, a colossally mistaken decision.
It was a mistaken decision, to be sure, but so was, from your perspective, toppling Mubarak. So I think from your perspective was pushing Vladimir Putin, who you saw as someone who felt very aggrieved, and trying to do things in NATO. I mean, you get into these situations where you look back in retrospect and you think, maybe I could have done something different, or maybe I couldn't have done something different.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one thing you learn is the limits of American agency in the world. I mean, you mentioned the Egyptian revolution in early 2011, the toppling of Hosni Mubarak. We were bitterly criticized in the Obama administration by the Saudis and many of our friends in the Gulf for pulling the rug out from under Hosni Mubarak. And the truth is that, you know, that was Egyptians. That was the agency of Egyptians. And the bus was, it wasn't as if we threw Hosni Mubarak under the bus. The bus was halfway across his prone political body by the time President Obama publicly said that there needed to be a change in Egypt. And so oftentimes I think both Americans, especially Americans in Washington and people in the Middle East, assume too central a role for the United States, assume too much about our agency. And the Egyptian revolution, even though there were lots of mistakes we made in the decades before that, of course we should have pushed the Egyptian leadership to open up its society more. There were tactical mistakes that we made. But once the revolution began, it was Egyptians who had agency at that point.
But I get back to my original question, though. When you found yourself at odds and when you were really feeling like you should go to the mat and didn't, why not?
Well, I mean, I think you have an obligation in a disciplined civilian service, just like the U.S. military, that if you get a lawful instruction, you have a choice. You either carry it out to the best of your ability or you resign. And I have enormous admiration for, I think there were three of my colleagues in the State Department who resigned over the war in Iraq in 2003. There were about 20 over the Balkans in the early 1990s who resigned, a number who've resigned over the course of the last couple of years in the Trump administration. I think it's also an honorable thing to try to work from within. But what that means is you have an obligation to be honest about your concerns, even when that's not convenient. And that's what I think it's essential to try to do in a place like the State Department, is create an atmosphere where people are going to feel that sense of obligation, where they're going to feel free to make their concerns known. Otherwise, you end up making some, you know, really bad policy choices.
Our guest is Ambassador William Burns, author of The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. And I want to talk about that case. But before I do, let's talk about the Middle East some more, particularly since we had Valerie Jarrett on just last week and we were talking about the red line and Syria. And she felt, well, perhaps something should have been done because of the use of chemical weapons by Bashar Assad, but nothing was done. And maybe that was a mistake in retrospect. Was it a mistake?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, I think, you know, when the United States publicly draws a red line over crossing a really important international norm, which is the use of chemical weapons in that instance to kill about 1,100 innocent Syrian civilians, mostly women and children, I think it's important to follow through on that. And I think that was one place. I always had huge respect for President Obama's concern with the cloud of Iraq 2003 hanging over American foreign policy and our choices. I had huge respect for his concern about getting on a slippery slope that would drag the United States into yet another big military intervention in the Middle East. I think that was one instance where we could have responded militarily in a punitive strike to reinforce that international norm that there were consequences if you used chemical weapons against your own people, where we could have done that and not run the risk of sliding into a big, you know, military intervention on the ground in Syria. So, yeah, I think we should have responded.
President Trump did send a missile over there, too. And I'm interested in your thoughts now about Yemen, which is the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world and ongoing. And our relations with the Saudis seem to be pretty cozy in spite of what happened at Khashoggi and in spite of the fact that they are it's complicated in Yemen. I don't want to put all of the weight on them, but clearly what they've done in terms of human rights violations and so forth is despicable. So where can diplomacy help here, or can it help here, especially with the present administration, which has very few people in the State Department, has very few people in national security?
Well, I think first on Yemen, I agree with you. I think it's not only a humanitarian catastrophe, but also a strategic catastrophe for the Saudis as well at this point. I mean, they're spending billions of dollars. There are thousands of Yemeni civilians being killed. And I think it's time to end the fighting and move toward a diplomatic resolution. And that's easier said than done, but it's not impossible to do. And that's where the United States, I think, as a country that's long had a friendly relationship with Saudi Arabia for all the imperfections of Saudi behavior, needs to be honest and straight about our concerns about Saudi overreach in Yemen. And I think overreach in terms of its political repression at home as well, the murder of Mr. Khashoggi, you know, a Saudi journalist in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. You know, that's an instance where the United States needs to be clear with the Saudi leadership that, of course, will support efforts at social and economic modernization at home. They're long overdue. Of course, we'll support Saudi Arabia where it faces legitimate external threats. But we're also going to be honest and try to make the relationship a two-way street when it comes to those instances of overreach, whether it's political repression at home or the catastrophe in Yemen.
We're talking about diplomacy with William Burns. Again, his book is called The Back Channel, A Memoir of American Diplomacy and the Case for Its Renewal. And we will talk about what can be done to enhance diplomacy in this state of the world now where the United States is an increasingly lesser role than it had back in 1991, which I said is where he begins his book, in Madrid, when things were pretty heady. If you'd like to join this conversation, I want to invite you to do that now. We do want to hear from you, hear your thoughts and questions you might have for the former Deputy Secretary of State and Ambassador Bill Burns. And you can join us at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to be part of the program and the conversation. Welcome your thoughts. The number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And interested to hear, especially from what our listeners think about the role of diplomacy and how diplomacy can play a singular role, or for that matter, a tactical role in terms of the world we are faced with now in geopolitics. I should also mention that the ambassador will be at the Commonwealth Club on Wednesday at 6:30 p.m., and he'll also be at Stanford this evening from 7 to 8:30 at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. Stay tuned for more. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with William Burns, who is the author of The Back Channel, A Memoir of American Diplomacy and the Case for Its Renewal. Served as a diplomat, as an ambassador, and certainly as a member of the State Department and Deputy Secretary of State, and served, I should mention, in five presidents, and that's three Republicans and two Democrats, and also for 10 Secretaries of State. And the book is The Back Channel, A Memoir of American Diplomacy and the Case for Its Renewal. And we're going to go to your calls here. But first, I'd want to go to this whole idea of renewal and what can be done with Bill Burns. I should also mention there's a lovely little anecdote that you tell about Harold Macmillan in your book, where somebody said, why do things go wrong in terms of all the planning where diplomacy is concerned? And basically his answer was, events, my dear boy, events. And that certainly is very, I think, categorically inclusive of what can happen and what cannot be predicted about what happens. But you lay out some things here that I just want our listeners to be aware of that I think are really quite important, and particularly now in your new role as the head of Carnegie. You're talking about the value of U.S. diplomacy really throughout the book, that it has to have a clear sense of purpose. It has to stop preaching and act more by example. But also talking about a compact with the American people. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, the truth is that there's a disconnect that's been widening between people like me, card-carrying members of the Washington establishment, and lots of American citizens over the course of recent decades since the end of the Cold War. We preach the virtues of disciplined American leadership in the world. Most Americans, in my experience around the country, you know, don't need to be convinced of the value of American engagement in the world. They get it in terms of our security, in terms of our, you know, economic prosperity. But they're more skeptical about the disciplined part because they've seen, whether it was Iraq in 2003 and the global financial crisis a few years later, you know, instances where we weren't disciplined, where we didn't match ends to means, where hubris got in the way of, you know, smart analysis of American foreign policy in the world. So, you know, there's a really important challenge involved in trying to narrow that disconnect. And again, whomever succeeds the current administration is going to have to come to grips with that. It's not going to be enough just to see the back of this president, because that drift has been going on for a while. So we all tell ourselves, rightly, that smart foreign policy begins at home in a strong political and economic system. That's absolutely crucial. But we have to do a better job of making clear to Americans that it ends there, too. It ends in more jobs and better security and a healthier environment and a range of issues like that. And that's going to require, you know, not only the State Department as an institution, but, you know, an elected political leadership that's going to take seriously those kind of concerns on the part of Americans and try to address them a little more effectively than we've done in the past.
You see anybody on the horizon who looks promising in that?
No, I mean, I think there are lots of smart candidates already who are running for president. I think, you know, I'm deeply impressed by the number of young Americans who've joined the Foreign Service in recent years. I mean, you know, we're very fortunate in the hand we have to play as Americans, even if it's, you know, not that singular dominant hand we had to play at the very end of the Cold War. But, you know, we've got to be honest, I think, with the mistakes we've made and the challenges we have before us.
I've got a lot of calls, and I want to go to as many of them as possible. One more thing I wanted to touch on, though, in terms of the future and renewal, and that is your recommendation is pretty strong for economic development, particularly when we think about all the migrants that want to come into this country. You're talking about Latin American countries, economically developing those countries and helping develop them in ways that will stave off all of this influx.
Sure. I mean, you look at the recent decision that the White House made a couple of weeks ago to cut off U.S. development assistance to three Central American countries. And I think that has the challenge exactly wrong. You know, if we want to deal with, you know, what has been a surge in the efforts of people in those three Central American countries to escape disorder and chaos in their own countries and a lack of dignity and opportunity and come to the United States, creating pressures on our borders, then, you know, what we need to do is to try to anchor them in a sense of possibility in their own societies. And that's where smartly directed development assistance can be a very important tool. Cutting off that tool, I think, is exactly the wrong way to go about a strategy for dealing with this challenge.
Let's bring our callers aboard here, and we'll begin with John. John, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I adore this show, and thank you so very much. My question is, I find diplomacy to be elegant and wildly important and sadly lacking. So this conversation is very, very timely. I was just talking to a good friend about this yesterday. Because it's going to require some big ideas and some action because it's been on the downtrend for so long, how bloated is the bureaucracy? And if so, how would one engage in a solution when around them is obstacles and flabby bureaucrats that may or may not be supportive of your idea? I mean, how difficult is it to get away from the idea table and actually affect action?
It's a really good question, John. I mean, I would say two things in response. First, you know, the American diplomatic service is actually pretty small. There's only about 8,500 U.S. Foreign Service officers in the world today. The former Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates, used to remind people that there are more members of American military bands than there are American diplomats. I have nothing against military music, but I mean, there's an imbalance there. So it's not such a huge institution, at least in terms of the diplomatic service. But you're right about the flabbiness in the way in which we in the State Department for many years have approached the challenges of diplomacy. While there are many individual American diplomats who are incredibly innovative and resourceful and courageous sometimes, as an institution, the State Department is rarely accused of being too agile or too full of initiative. So you're right. We got to be self-critical in the ways in which we try to make ourselves a more nimble institution. But we're a relatively small institution, too, especially compared to the size of the U.S. military, other parts of the federal government. So it's possible, I think, to begin that process of reform and get the most out of American diplomacy.
Many thanks for the call, John. Oh, John, you had a follow-up. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, just quick, if you don't mind. So there's a contrast there when you say that it's nimble. I would imagine that a nimble, smaller organization, and 8,500 actually sounds like a totally sufficient number for what you're talking about globally. So why wouldn't a nimble organization be easier to trim? I mean, there's a strange dichotomy there in what you were saying.
Yeah, no, it's a fair question, John. I mean, I think in terms of its size, I mean, I think it's suited to the purpose. You know, given the number of places around the world in which the United States operates embassies or consulates, I think the challenge, as you rightly point out, is to help us get out of our own way, to delayer the organization a little bit, you know, so that, you know, we're not so cumbersome sometimes in the way in which we make choices and implement policies. So it's not a question so much of the size, at least in the State Department, as it is of reforming the place to make it more agile. And I think that's possible to do.
And John, I thank you. It used to be that a lot of ambassadorships were given to people who gave a lot of money to campaigns and all the like. And it was kind of scandalous for many years because there were people who were sent to different countries as diplomats who didn't even know the language. Now, I know you're fluent in Russian and Arabic, and you served as ambassador to Russia and Jordan, also fluent in French. And I mention that because how fluent, and I mean fluent in the broader sense, not just in language, but how fluent in the cultures, for example, are members of the State Department now in terms of their interface?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm always impressed, especially with the quality of younger diplomats who came into the Foreign Service, you know, in the last couple of decades. I would meet with each of the entering classes of diplomats. In many ways, I was glad I didn't have to compete with them, you know, when I was joining the Foreign Service, because their language facility, their experience in the world, many of them have either served in the military or served in the Peace Corps, served overseas, or worked in the private sector before they came into the diplomatic service. It's really quite impressive. One of the sad things today is after more than two decades in which every year the number of Americans applying to join the Foreign Service increased, over the last couple of years there's been an almost 50% drop. And you see a huge number of senior vacancies in the State Department today, not just in Washington, but also some of our most important diplomatic posts overseas.
And some of the finest diplomats who are not there any longer, right?
That's right. And that's really hard to repair over time. You know, when President Trump was asked whether he was concerned about the number of senior vacancies in the State Department and in ambassadorial posts overseas about a year ago, he said, "Not really, because I'm the only one who matters." That really is diplomacy as an exercise in narcissism. And if we hollow out the institution for all of its imperfections, as you know, one of our callers was indicating earlier, then we really do a disservice to advancing American interests and values in the world at precisely the moment when diplomacy matters more than ever.
Another caller joining us. It's TJ. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I hope this is a good question to ask. It's about the partition of Korea after World War II and the current North-South Korea situation. When we've had these talks with North Korea about disarmament and ending the armistice and peace, I understand that North Korea doesn't want South Korea there. And I'm curious, is it the position of North Korea that South Korea is a renegade province, the way China thinks of Taiwan? And is it the U.S. position that First, there should be a peace treaty between North Korea and South Korea before there can be one between the U.S. and North Korea. And I have a cold, so I'm going to take my answer off the air.
All right. I hope your cold gets better, TJ, and thank you for that call. William Burns.
Thanks. No, I mean, you know, the United States has, you know, had an important treaty relationship and alliance with South Korea, with the Republic of Korea for a long time. And, you know, the security of South Korea is very important for the United States. North Korea has posed a huge challenge, not just to South Korea's security, but with the development of its nuclear and missile programs, you know, a wider challenge, including to the homeland of the United States itself. I think diplomacy is a really important tool to try to limit and ultimately, you know, limit those dangers and ultimately denuclearize North Korea. Where in that process a peace treaty would fit, where in that process a declaration of normal relations would fit, you know, after, you know, a situation in which we've technically been in conflict with North Korea for decades now.
Still at war, technically.
Yeah, right. And so that's the challenge of diplomacy, is where do you arrange those pieces? And it's a very difficult challenge, but not an impossible one. So, you know, in that sense, I applaud the current administration's effort to take on diplomacy with North Korea. I just think it's really important to avoid over-personalizing it. It's really important to work closely with our allies. It's really important to be realistic about what we can achieve. And I think a kind of step-by-step approach, which limits those dangers, is likely to produce more results than an approach which is sort of characterized as either go big, in other words, you have a comprehensive agreement in one fell swoop, or you go home. And I think that carries with it a lot of risk.
It's always been my notion, though, that the Trump administration is working perhaps a different kind of back channel. This is just surmising, but they talked a lot about these great beaches in North Korea. In other words, economic development again. We'll do this for you, quid pro quo, and you just help me get a Nobel Prize, right?
Yeah, but I think the North Korean leadership is pretty unsentimental about, you know, the sort of economic development prospects. I think Kim Jong-un today sees holding on to those nuclear weapons as crucial to his security, his stature, his survival. So, you know, I don't know that he's going to be, you know, lulled or swayed much by images of, you know, Trump hotels going up on beaches in North Korea.
Just staying with North Korea for a moment, Mike, one of our listeners, sends in this email. North Korea, he writes, is hermetically sealed. How could there be the sort of lower-level diplomat-to-diplomat contact Mr. Burns suggests?
It's really tough. As your listener points out, you know, it's a leadership which maintains pretty iron discipline over diplomats at lower levels. But I think, you know, that's the challenge for an American president, is to make clear the North Korean president that he needs to, the North Korean leader, that he needs to empower his diplomats to engage in that kind of day-to-day interaction. Because otherwise, you know, I don't see how you can flesh out practical steps.
And we'll engage another caller, and that's you, Simon. Welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm curious to know Mr. Burns' thoughts on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. This two-state solution seems to be on life support, and I'm wondering, you know, can it be revived? And what are some of the alternatives that may be on the table?
Thank you for the question, Simon.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Simon. And I must admit, I share your concern about the drift away from a two-state solution right now. You know, there's a lot of talk of the Trump White House releasing a new peace plan, the deal of the century. But it just seems to me that it's based on a series of flawed assumptions. You know, first, that you can that the United States can help make progress by just dealing with one party. I think it's been more than a year since there's really been much interaction with the Palestinian leadership. Second, the flawed assumption that somehow you can negotiate over the heads of Palestinians. You can get some Arab states, the Saudis and others, who share, understandably, a concern with the Israeli leadership about potential Iranian threats. But I don't think that's a substitute for Palestinians and Israelis negotiating. Another flawed assumption, I think, is the notion that you can substitute economic possibilities for political dignity. You can do some new Marshall Plan, and that's going to substitute for a sovereign Palestinian state. And then there's the flawed assumption that somehow time is on our side, which I don't really believe as a matter of either Palestinian or Israeli interests or the interests of the United States, because we're close to the point whereas a two-state solution will expire. And I think if you look at the reality that in the next 5 or 10 years, Arabs are going to be in the majority in the land that Israel controls from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, then it's hard for me to imagine how you sustain a Jewish democratic state in that area, given that reality. And so I worry that, you know, if this plan comes out, it's actually going to put the last nail in the coffin of a two-state solution rather than advancing the possibilities for achieving it.
Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu has talked as if he supports a two-state solution. I mean, it was rhetoric, and clearly, in terms of his political power, that is not where he's going to go.
No, and I think you heard that the last stages of the recent Israeli election campaign talk of the possibility of formally annexing parts of the West Bank.
And the settlements going on, yeah.
That's right. And I think that would have a crippling effect on whatever prospect remains for a two-state solution.
Bring more callers aboard here. Washington is our next caller. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Great show. So the idea of America is rooted in the words of the founding fathers, you know, freedom, democracy, just good, competent governance. But over the last couple of years, especially at the highest level of the current administration, we have seen an abrogation of everything that America stands for. And my question is, what are the long-term impact of this going on in Washington, and how the rest of the world will start seeing America as this shining city on the hill that doesn't live up to the very ideals that it pontificates about to the rest of the world?
It's a really good question. I've always thought, as a diplomat serving overseas for many, many years, that the United States gets a lot farther in the world through the power of our example than we do through the power of our preaching. With all of our imperfections, with all of the mistakes we've made over the years, I think that's not just a moral issue, it's a practical one. It helps underpin our influence in the world. And I think, you know, as we do pretty severe damage to that power of our example these days, as people around the world look at the United States and our dysfunction, our polarization, the inadequacy of our current leadership, I think that's going to do real corrosive damage. And what I worry is that, you know, we're digging a hole for ourselves on the international landscape today at a moment of profound transformation. It's not as if everybody else around the world is waiting for us to get our act together. We'll stop digging eventually. But my concern is we're going to climb back to the top of the hole and look out on a landscape that's hardened in some ways against our interests and against the idea of America as well, because there are a lot of authoritarians around the world today who feel the wind in their sails, and a lot of democratic systems, not just in this country, having nervous breakdowns on both sides of the Atlantic today as you look at Brexit in the United Kingdom. A lot of democratic systems are suffering from a real crisis of governance, and I think it's really crucial to restore a sense of faith and confidence in a political system that's worked well for the United States in the past, and we're doing a lot of damage to that today.
There's a listener named Anne who writes, "We are in a period of seemingly minimal diplomacy with many national security agencies leaderless. Does Ambassador Burns find this confluence alarming? I do."
Yeah, I share your alarm, man. I find it deeply alarming. I think we face a reality today where the State Department, my mold institution, is in many respects being hollowed out. And you have a drift in the way in which foreign policy is made or formulated in Washington and then conducted overseas. Again, as I was suggesting before, at precisely the moment when diplomacy actually matters more than ever to American interests and values. So I'm quite concerned about it.
Well, we also have a president who, as you indicated earlier, feels he can fix everything. He's even said that, and who looks to autocratic power as a kind of paradigm that he would like to have flourish in his administration. And so many Americans feel, in terms of diplomacy, what can we do?
Well, I mean, I think you also have a president who's fostered an atmosphere in which public service, not just diplomatic service, is oftentimes belittled and demeaned. And that's a huge mistake, not only because there are lots of American public servants, as, you know, we're talking and listening today, who are carrying out hard jobs in hard places around the world. They deserve our respect. They don't deserve to be belittled. there are lots of ways in which we can reform those institutions, make them more agile and more nimble. But for the United States to, you know, advance our interests and the values that matter not just to us but to lots of other societies in the world today, you know, you need that body of expertise of, you know, committed public servants who will help advance those goals.
And you have people who don't even want to serve in this administration, though. I mean, because of the feelings they have toward the president.
Yeah, no, I mean, the performance of this administration over the last 2.5 years has not exactly been a great recruiting poster for the Foreign Service or for other elements of public service. But I still strongly encourage young people and not so young people to join public service, to join the Foreign Service, because there is going to come a moment of renewal. And it's not only crucial for the government to attract the best possible people, to create a Foreign Service that actually looks like the society we represent. And that's been another of the negative trends in the last couple of years. You know, we made painfully slow progress over the course of the 3.5 decades I was a professional diplomat to try to create a little bit better ethnic and gender balance and diversity in the Foreign Service. You know, when I joined the Foreign Service, most American diplomats looked like me. 9 out of 10 American diplomats were white, and only about a quarter were women. We made painfully slow progress in a better direction. Now a lot of those trend lines are being reversed. That also costs us overseas.
We get to some more calls, but I also want to read something that you define early on in your book as the nature of diplomacy or diplomatic work. You say it is among the oldest of professions, but it is also among the most misunderstood and the most unsatisfying to describe. It is by nature an unheroic, quiet endeavor, less swaggering than unrelenting, often unfolding in back channels out of sight and out of mind. Its successes are rarely celebrated, its failures almost always scrutinized. Even as visible and accomplished a practitioner as Henry Kissinger has called diplomacy the patient accumulation of partial successes, hardly the stuff of bumper stickers, and maybe hardly the stuff that would be a magnet for lots of young idealistic people. But you're saying it should be and it ought to be.
Yeah, and I really think it should be. I mean, I wouldn't have traded a moment. Maybe there's a few moments I would have traded in the course of my 3.5
You can think of a few in your career.
Three and a half decades as a diplomat. But it's, you know, it's wonderful to find a cause, in this case, the interests of my own country, that, you know, enable you to be part of something bigger than yourself. I remember my dad, who was a career Army officer, from whom I learned to respect public service, wrote me a letter right after I had taken the written exam for the Foreign Service, and I was trying to think of what I should do. And he said that nothing will ever make you prouder than to serve your country with honor. And it didn't make a big impression on me at the time. But over the next 3.5 decades, I really learned the wisdom of that, at least for me. And so I urge people to consider a career in public service. I think, especially after the experience of the last couple of years, it's more important than ever.
Let me go to another caller, and that's you, Michelle. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for all the service you've given over the decades to our country, sir.
Thank you.
I would like to ask, we have 1%, less than 1% that we give to the rest of the world in assistance from our own GDP from the U.S. If it went to an actual tithe of 10%, what would our world look like? And coming from a background of being a former Veteran for Peace member, I would like to see also the Department of Peace be instituted. How could that happen? And what would our world look like? Where would you direct those funds?
Well, I think there's a lot that can be done, I think, with U.S. development assistance funds in the world. I think there's a lot that can be done to leverage what we do to encourage other countries and private institutions as well to do more. You look at the challenge, for example, of climate change and the ways in which if countries and societies around the world pooled their resources, we really could make progress in dealing with a genuine existential threat. I think that would all be a very positive thing. You're right in terms of the U.S. federal budget. The entire percentage of that budget that goes to diplomacy and development, all of our foreign assistance, is less than 1% of the federal budget. You know, the most recent budget proposal from the Trump White House was for $40 billion for the State Department and all of our foreign assistance programs, which is a lot of money, I recognize, but $750 billion for the Defense Department and the U.S. military, so roughly 19 times more. you're never going to get very far in diplomacy unless you have a strong military. That's just a reality. But that's a foolish imbalance, I think, and it's getting wider in this administration. So I think you're absolutely right to focus on the importance of ensuring that we're generating enough budget support for development assistance, because if you want to get at the challenges of violent extremism and terrorism in the world, you know what's animated us in many ways since 9/11, you can't only deal with the symptoms of those problems, as vicious as they are in terrorist groups. You also have to deal with the deeper drivers of change, not just in the Middle East, but in many other parts of the world, if you want to help create an order which is going to benefit not just the United States, but sort of the wider enlightened self-interest that we ought to employ in looking at the world.
We're also dealing, though, in so many instances with ideology, aren't we?
We are. I mean, and I think we have to recognize there's a pretty serious competition in ideas right now. You know, where I started the book in the George H.W. Bush, Jim Baker era, that was a moment when people wrote about the end of history. It seemed like that
Fukuyama, yeah.
Right. It seemed like that ideological competition was over. The reality, as Frank Fukuyama pointed out at the time, that if democratic systems didn't generate results for people, if they didn't demonstrate they could govern effectively, authoritarians or other kind of isms were going to gain traction. And that's just what's happened in recent years.
Bill Burns, thank you so much for joining us this hour of Forum. Congratulations on a sterling career and on your book, which again is The Back Channel, a memoir of American diplomacy and the case for its renewal. And he is now the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And as I said, we'll be at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford this evening at 7 o'clock and tomorrow at the Commonwealth Club at 6:30. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening, and much more up ahead. We're going to talk about Notre Dame, and we're going to talk about PG&E, and that's in the hour coming up. Stay tuned after the news. We'll be back. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.